out, everybody.
What's up, everybody, and welcome back to another episode of Lights Out. I'm your host, Josh.
And I'm Ian.
And I'm the producer, Daniel.
And this is co-host Ian.
Co-host Ian, proper now.
Proper now, yes. Ian is now officially the new co-host for Lights Out.
Thank you.
Welcome, man.
Thank you. I'm very happy.
Even though you've been here for a while.
Yeah, I've been sitting in the chair, but it feels different. It feels more official now.
There's more pressure on you. No, I'm just kidding.
Absolutely.
Now it's go time. No, we're super excited though to have Ian officially here on the show. And you know, you guys made this very easy decision wise for me. And I mean, I already had my mindset that Ian was going to be it, but obviously I wanted to make sure that all of you out there approved. And the approval rating was through the roof.
And thank you guys. I mean, thank you. Thank you, Danny, as well, of course. But seriously, thank you to the fans. That was heartwarming to see.
Yeah, really they were clamoring for you to stick around. So here he is. And now you can never leave.
It's okay. Again, I'm strapped in the chair. You don't see the rope here, but
yeah. Well, I'm excited for this new chapter of Lights Out. And we've got a lot to plan. There may even be an additional person at some point in the future who will also be sitting in on the show as a producer. But that day has not come yet. And for now, it'll be the three of us. But today we've got this is probably one of the craziest cases I've ever come across. And I honestly couldn't believe the sheer level of brutality that took place between two housewives.
Two housewives. And I think that factor of it, the housewife factor of it, is ultimately what leads to the, I don't know, shocking conclusion to me of, you know, I don't want to give it away, but it that to me is the most upsetting part about this whole thing.
Yeah. I mean, a woman is murdered in cold blood in the most brutal way possible. And what unfolds after that is truly shocking.
Yeah.
And disturbing all at the same time, especially for that woman's family, because I couldn't imagine going through what they did. It is on a whole other level. But this takes place in a small town in Wiley, Texas. When I heard Wiley, it was like, I just thought of Wiley Coyote immediately. I wonder if that was where his name came from. But just a little town, you know, church going, families, you know, not a lot of people. Not a lot going on.
It's very classic, like Americana, you know?
Totally. Yeah. It almost feels like the set for a movie or something.
Right. You can see the tumbleweed blowing through.
Totally. Totally. You know, it's a place where this type of thing is certainly not common, but I mean, it just absolutely rocked the entire community. They just could not believe that something so violent could have happened.
Right.
I mean, it's crazy. But this is the case of Betty Gore and Candy Montgomery. So let's get into it here. So as we were talking about, this case takes place in Texas. And, you know, it's a place that, you know, especially in this time period, you know, everybody likes to say, oh, our town is so safe and, you know, keep your doors unlocked and everybody knows everybody. But nobody saw coming what eventually just completely rocked this small little town. And really, this is not just a story of, you know, a brutal murder, but it's the underlying story of, you know, kind of the things that happen in especially a small town like this, where kind of everybody knows everybody, but between families that were good friends with each other.
Right.
And you know, an affair sort of enters the picture, and it seems like that is sort of the instigator for potentially some of the things that follow. But, you know, is it, you know, we really don't fully understand what happened or what the motive was.
Right. We only have Candy's side of the story.
Right.
And I think this is another interesting case because you can almost track it into, you know, this American narrative of the American dream, right? Of it fracturing, of, you know, this 1950s idea of like, the husband goes to work, the housewife stays home, and everything's perfect. And I think by the 70s, not only in this case, but in many others, you know, you can start to see that fall apart. And you can start to see the growing need for both the husband at work and in the day-to-day life and the housewife at home for a more exciting life.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I think this case is kind of the most extreme example of what can happen.
Totally. No, 100%. So in the late 1970s, Wiley, Texas was a small town where nothing really bad seemed to happen. It's sitting about a half an hour from Dallas. It was home to roughly 3,700 people, and it offered a very peaceful suburban way of life. Just families, lots of churches, and quiet streets. And people in Wiley focused on their homes, their kids, and of course, attending church on Sundays. And like Ian has been saying, it's really, you know, that quintessential American dream, you know, sort of place where it's kind of simple life. You work, kids go to school, you go to church on Sundays, and everything is just grand.
Everything's perfect.
Right.
Lawns are mowed.
Yeah, lawns are mowed. And for a while, that's exactly what it was for the two women at the center of today's case. But before we get into what happened, let's talk about who they were. Starting with the victim, Betty Gore.
Betty Eileen Pomeroy was born on January 9th, 1950, in Harper, Kansas, to her parents Bob and Bertha Pomeroy. She was the oldest of the three children with two younger brothers, and the Pomeroys lived on a family farm in the small town of Norwich, Kansas. And they led a very humble, quiet life. The family's farm was on the west end of town and had no running water. They used an outhouse. Eventually, her father purchased a gas station, and they moved to another house with more modern conveniences. And in the documentary, one of the brothers stated, like, it was a huge deal when we got plumbing and running water.
Yeah. Can you imagine? Yeah. Their outhouse wasn't like right outside the home too. They had to walk like a good ways over to the outhouse by the garage. And they're like, winter. It was pretty rough in the winter.
Yeah. Too. Jesus.
That's hard to even imagine these days of like having to go to an outhouse.
Right. I think that's how my grandpa lived in the 30s.
Yeah.
You know, by this time you'd think all that was sorted.
Well, this was a really old house. This was actually, I believe it was Bob or Bertha's parents' house. So it had been there for a long, long time and was never built with those modern conveniences.
Just go to the outhouse.
Yep.
Growing up in Kansas, Betty was, quite well-liked by her classmates. As one family member recalled, she was a popular student, involved in tons of activities, and had a lot of friends. According to everyone who knew her, she had a very warm and caring personality and got along with just about everyone. After graduating from high school, Betty went to college to become a teacher, and while there, she fell in love with her math tutor, Alan Gore. They married 3 years later in January 1970, and Alan took a job as a defense contractor at Rockwell International in Dallas. The couple settled in Wiley, Texas in 1977, where Betty became a fifth grade teacher at an elementary school. And before long, they welcomed their first daughter, Elisa. And, at this point, the family, this is like kind of Betty's dream, right? She always wanted to be a teacher. Now she's also a mother. She's met, what she believes to be the love of her life. And they're settled into this really tight-knit community of Wiley.
White picket fence.
Right.
Little neighborhoods. Life was good.
All right. Everything's coming together. Life looks simple. That is, until they joined the First Methodist Church of Lucas, Texas. They had no idea that getting involved with their church would change everything, because that is where they met Candy Montgomery.
Which, that's the other wild thing with this case, is that these two women meet each other at church.
At church. Church is central to this case. I mean, it really is the catapult to what happens.
Yeah.
So, Candy was born Candace Lynn Wheeler on November 15th, 1949. She grew up as an army brat, moving from place to place throughout her childhood, never quite staying in one spot long enough to feel at home. She didn't really put down roots until her 20s, when she met her husband, Pat Montgomery. Pat worked as an electrical engineer at Texas Instruments, and by 1977, he and Candy were living in Wiley with their children. Around that time, Candy left her job as a secretary to become a stay-at-home mom. On the surface, Candy appeared to be an active and happy member of her community. She attended school events, went to social gatherings, and helped with children's Sunday school. But she told friends that she felt bored. She said her relationship with Pat wasn't as exciting as it used to be. She wanted something new, and she eventually found that in the people around her at church.
Candy and Pat became very active members at that First Methodist Church of Lucas, and that is where they became close with another couple, Betty and Alan Gore. And the two families hit it off quickly. Their daughters were close in age and became best friends, and from the outside, it looked like one of those connections that just works. You know, two families, you know, church is a great place to find friends, and, you know, you find other parents that are similar to you, and, you know, they have kids that are the same age as you. It really works out. So, but even though they spent a lot of time together, Candy and Betty were very different people. Betty was shy and anxious, while Candy was warm and outgoing. The kind of person who is very ingrained in the community. I mean, she was ingrained in the church. She just liked to be around people. Very social. And Betty could come across as difficult at times, while Candy just seemed to move through social situations with ease, and people really seemed to gravitate towards her. They weren't the closest of friends, but they got along. And despite all their differences, they had one important thing in common. They were both quietly struggling in their marriages. Nobody talked about that part, though, because that was the other thing, is like, you just keep that. That was very private, especially
right.
back then. You know,
right.
Even with friends, you weren't disclosing what was going on behind closed doors in your marriage.
And I think it was way more prevalent. I mean, compared divorce rates then to divorce rates now. And I think, like, in a lot of the pop culture that we consume now, like Mad Men or whatever, about this you know, around this time period, this is a constant theme, is that there are marriage issues and people don't address them.
No. You know, women a lot of times just suffered silently.
Right.
You know, or dealt with an abusive husband, or dealt with just a husband that's absent.
Right.
And they're essentially a single parent. And so it was really, really tough. And Betty and Alan were really dealing with a lot of a strain on their relationship, because Alan traveled constantly for work, and Betty was really struggling with being home alone, managing the household, the school year, and all the routines. And of course, handling multiple kids, which I know very well. Kendall was on a little trip and I was juggling both kids last night, and it's tough.
Yeah.
It's tough, especially when you got an infant and a toddler. It is not easy. So I have major respect and love for any single parent out there, because it is rough. It's hard.
Right.
At the same time, Betty desperately wanted a second child, so she began planning the pregnancy with meticulous precision, aiming to align the timing with her teaching schedule. But Alan had started to feel like the romance in their relationship had all but disappeared. Like, any intimacy between them had basically become transactional, which, that's not a good place to be in a relationship, especially a marriage. Of like, your relationship should never feel transactional.
No. And I think, you know, again, now in more contemporary studies, we understand this is like, this is the first stage of like, okay, we need to find help
yeah.
in our marriage.
Marriage counseling exists right. for this very reason.
Right.
That was the other thing. People didn't do that.
No.
Or, you know, like when, you know, growing up, my parents had marital issues. It was like, go to the pastor.
Exactly.
It was like, yeah. go to the church, to the qualified, you know, professional there.
Right? And who's waiting at church for them in this case? You know.
Yeah. Other couple. But meanwhile, Candy was also restless in her own marriage, that she began to openly start telling her friends that she was thinking about having an affair, just publicly. She just did not give a shit. She's like, you know, it's getting boring. You know, anybody?
I'm
open?
Considering these things.
Yeah. And, you know, obviously it wasn't, you know, maybe some of those people thought she was just venting or just sort of, you know, blowing smoke or whatever. But Candy was serious. She was
right.
actually wanting to enter into an affair. And she was already starting to look around. And what no one knew at the time was how quickly all of this would move. Because it all started in the summer of 1978. Candy and Alan were on the same team in their church volleyball league. And one evening during a game, the two of them went for the same ball and collided. And, you know, this innocent accident became something that Candy could not shake. She later said she smelled him in that moment and felt a surge of something electric. You think you'd feel pain in that moment,
yeah, you'd think,
crashing into each other, but she got a whiff of Alan and she's like, yeah, this is the guy.
I like him.
She's like, this was an excitement that I hadn't felt in years. and something woke her up that day. And she really hadn't given Alan much thought before that, because he was quiet, sort of unassuming. But after the volleyball game, that changed. The attraction became something she just couldn't push aside, and she became determined to act on it. A few weeks later, she did. After choir practice one night, Candy walked right up to Alan's car, opened the passenger door, and leaned in. She told him she had been thinking about him, that she was attracted to him and wanted him to know. Then she closed the door and walked away, and the two of them acted like it had never happened. But a few weeks after that, Candy tried again. They stayed late after volleyball practice, and when they were leaving, Candy asked him to get into her car. And he didn't say yes or no, but he kissed her before he got out. So kind of seems like he picked up on what she was putting down, right? And that was kind of like the acknowledgement of her advance. And honestly, he was like, all right, I like what we're doing here.
Right. He expressed that there was, that this attraction is mutual.
Right. But then after that, there wasn't a whole lot. There was a few weeks of silence. And then on Candy's 29th birthday, she got an unexpected call from Alan. He told her that he needed to have his tires replaced in McKinney and asked if she could meet him for lunch there. He said he wanted to talk about the possibility of an affair. And Candy said, yes, please.
Yep.
So when she got to the shop, he handed her a birthday card that read, "For the last of the Red Hot Lovers." Inside was a small pack of Red Hot's candy, which, you know, that's kind of seductive.
I think there's, you know, we compare this to, you know, our modern idea of cheating and situationships, and it's just very, like, blasé. Whereas, like, back then,
it's like a text message or something.
Right, like, yeah. What's going on?
Yeah.
Whereas back then, it's like, you know, yeah, it's what they're doing is taboo, but there's still this expectation of courtship.
Totally. Yeah. That's some effort there.
Right.
They then drove to a nearby tea house, had lunch, and Alan finally brought it up. He said he was apprehensive, as he had never done anything like this before. And, you know, Alan has a soul and, you know, a moral compass, it seems like, to some extent. And he said he was worried about hurting Betty. But by the end of lunch, they still hadn't made a decision on how they were going to proceed. So their conversations continued.
And I think this might be one of the stranger elements of it, because the affair didn't start hot and heavy. It started with strategy sessions, long, detailed discussions about whether they were even going to do this, which, you know, that does not fit our idea of an affair, you know.
No, in our world, it'd be they're going into the bathroom of that
right
lunch spot.
We're going
or
crazy.
Or the car or something.
Yeah. But no, they're like, let's get this in writing. They talked on the phone. They talked over lunch during Alan's breaks at work. Then, in late November 1978, Candy invited him over while Pat was gone. Not to start the affair, but to continue the conversation. Alan walked in and saw a massive piece of paper on the living room wall, divided into two columns. Why and why not? After eating Candy's homemade lasagna, the two of them sat down and worked through it together.
This is just wild, isn't it?
It's like a pros and cons list.
What? Yeah, it's like, it's hard not to laugh at this, because it's like, what on earth? She put a piece of paper on the wall with
right.
The pros and cons list?
I can't help, and maybe this is completely wrong, but I can't help to imagine what kind of media they were consuming that informed their idea behind what an affair could be. And you know, I see these strategy sessions as them attempting to map themselves onto these characters.
Yeah.
Because this, you know, this is a world they don't know at all.
No, clearly.
Yeah,
clearly no experience here.
After an episode about a housewife who walked free, it can help to have a place to unpack the heavy stuff. Even if a new co-host feels strapped in the chair, support does not have to be hard to reach. Talkspace connects you with licensed therapists, psychiatrists, and nurse practitioners across all 50 states. Choose live video, audio, or chat sessions that fit your day. Care is available every day, at any time, so mental health support can fit your routine. Plans start at $69 a week, and most insured members receive Talkspace for free. If the first match is not right, switch providers at no extra cost. Talkspace is in network with most major insurers, and most insured members have a $0 copay. No insurance, no problem. Now get $80 off of your first month when you go to talkspace.com and enter promo code SPACE80. That's SPACE80. Match with a licensed therapist today at Talkspace.com.
Then things got even more complicated. Betty and Alan had just found out that she was pregnant with their second child. Alan felt the guilt intensifying. He was interested in going forward with his affair with Candy, and he also felt terrible about it. But a few days later, he called her again. He made a decision. Alan wanted to proceed.
So with that, they agreed on a set of ground rules. If either of them wanted to end the affair, it would end immediately. If they became emotionally involved, they would call it off. They would split the cost of the motel and meal expenses. They would only meet on Tuesdays or Thursdays during Alan's lunch breaks. Candy would be in charge of booking the motel. She would also make and bring lunch for them so they could spend all of Alan's 2-hour break together at the motel. And the most important rule was that they could never tell anyone what they were doing. And after both agreed, they set a date to meet.
What a weird agreement. I mean, I guess they're trying to go about it sneaky and safe as much as they possibly can.
So let's leave a paper trail.
Yeah, literally. It seems like, that's a lot of time.
It's a lot of time. And I don't know, I feel like, you know, with Alan's side, you know, we just expressed how he was feeling his relationship was transactional. What's this, you know?
Yeah, literally. This is about as transactional as it gets. Right. What are you drawing up an affair agreement here?
And we're going Dutch on our, what are we doing?
Where's the romance in this? I don't see anything explosive or fireworks going off with this. Like, all right, you'll meet me during my lunch break on Tuesdays and Thursdays.
Mm-hmm. I'll pay this week. Yeah. We'll pay that week.
Yeah. My God. These two. It's just weird that, I mean, it kind of seems like Candy's in the driver's seat too.
Yeah, definitely.
Like, as much as Alan is a participant in this, it seems like Candy is definitely kind of in control here. And for what reason she's laying this out the way she is, I'm not really sure, but it's like, I guess maybe that was hot to them. I don't know. Doesn't make any sense.
I mean, that's actually a good point. Maybe this is what they find attractive, you know?
Like, let's pretend to be like a married couple or something. There's no spontaneity. It's just, here's our schedule and routine. We will stick to it.
Boom.
And never tell anybody.
And make sure to have fun.
Yeah, exactly.
So on December 12th, 1978, Candy spent the day preparing for her rendezvous with Alan. She made an extravagant lunch for them. Marinated chicken, a salad, white wine, and a homemade cheesecake. She even packed a nice tablecloth for the occasion. She also made sure to bring a nightgown.
Can't forget that nightgown.
Nope, the nightie, that's why she bought it.
Yeah. But can we just talk about that lunch? That's a pretty filling lunch.
That's a big lunch.
To have a romantic encounter with somebody afterwards. They did it before and then had lunch. But
that would be definitely preferred, but cheesecake before coitus?
Yeah, I don't know, man. And I mean, it sounds like they, in fact, enjoyed their meal together before moving on to the more physical parts.
I'm like, you want to see me bloated, babe?
Yeah, seriously.
At 11 a.m., she checked into a room at the Como Motel, just a few minutes from Alan's office. By the time he arrived, she was in her nightgown and the table was set like a dinner party in a motel room.
Romantic.
That is definitely Candy, like you're saying, in the driver's seat.
Oh, yeah.
Like, let me curate this experience.
Literally, yeah.
They talked while eating and cleaned up afterward. Candy sat quietly in a chair, and that is when Alan made the first move.
And yeah, you know what happens after that.
Mm-hmm. The affair was in full swing.
Things got hot and heavy.
Mm-hmm. They met every other week. Candy always brought something elaborate. Taco salads, lasagna, cheese blintzes, beef strips. They drank wine, they talked, and they fell into a rhythm together. Which, for a woman who hated routine, was a strange thing to admit. But as Betty got closer to giving birth, Alan began to feel the weight of what he was doing. He worried about missing the labor. The guilt was mounting for both of them. And yet, they kept meeting. They weren't ready to call off the affair right away. Instead, they kept up the bi-weekly meetup. Around that same time, Candy actually threw Betty a surprise baby shower. And I think...
diabolical, man.
Yeah, this is like, the cruelest part of it, is like maintaining this, you know, friendship between Candy and Betty. It's like, I'm sleeping with your husband, but I'm still throwing you a baby shower.
Which it makes you wonder if her quote-unquote friendship with Betty was literally transactional so that she could remain close to Alan.
Right.
Without being too suspicious.
Absolutely.
Right?
And maybe also to kind of pass off some of her guilt, being like,
well, I'm taking care of Betty.
Right.
You know,
right.
I'm helping her out.
Well, yeah. Through this tough pregnancy.
Yeah. God, wow, she's pregnant too. That's so fun.
And she told Betty she was hosting a church choir dinner. And when Betty walked in and realized that it was for her, she lit up. By all accounts, it was a lovely party. Nobody in that room had any idea what was really happening beneath the surface.
Because as the months go on, neither of them really felt the way that they had at the beginning. Alan's guilt over Betty had only deepened. Candy had stopped enjoying it since the affair, which was perhaps once exciting, maybe the first rendezvous they had. But now this whole thing was starting to feel more like a chore. Then in July 1979, Betty gave birth to their second daughter, Bethany. And Betty was thrilled. The baby gave her reason to focus and this renewed sense of purpose. And it gave both her and Alan a reason to try harder at their marriage, which meant Alan had to end things with Candy. I think it was just eating away at him. And of course, when you have a new baby, it just kind of puts everything into perspective right for you. Exactly when that conversation happened isn't entirely clear, but according to later testimony, it was calm. And Al explained that he needed to focus on his family. And the initial spark between Alan and Candy began to fade as the months passed. While Alan grappled with the increasing guilt regarding Betty, Candy simply found the arrangement less enjoyable, which just ultimately led the affair to fizzle out. While the physical affair ended quietly, the emotional aftermath was more complex, because Candy claimed she felt no devastation since her interest had already been waned, and yet the two families remained deeply intertwined through their church and their daughter's close relationship. They maintained a polite public relationship, and Candy and Alan were now bound by this permanent secret that they shared. So in late 1979, Betty was adjusting to life with a newborn. On the outside, it still looked like a joyful time, but those close to her later described her as overwhelmed. She was caring for an infant and a young child, often alone while Alan traveled. She struggled with sleep. She also struggled with anxiety and was taking medication for postpartum depression. And at the same time, Betty appeared to be growing more suspicious of Alan. She asked more questions and paid closer attention to his behavior. And whether that was just, you know, her intuition or anxiety or something that she had actually discovered, we're not really sure. But there was this growing tension in the Gore household. And in the meantime, Candy resumed her regular routine, appearing to everyone as his committed mother, an engaged member of her church and community. And on the surface, her life seemed perfectly stable.
During this period, another couple in their church began talking about a program called Marriage Encounter. If you haven't heard of it, Marriage Encounter was a popular program at the time, a structured weekend retreat organized through church communities, focused on communication, emotional honesty, and reconnection. Couples would do guided exercises, private written reflections, and sometimes deeply uncomfortable conversations about what wasn't working. Betty and Alan decided to participate in the retreat, leaving their daughters in the care of Candy and Pat for the duration of the weekend. They immersed themselves in the program and, upon their return, experienced a significant transformation in their relationship, feeling that the experience had been truly beneficial. Candy and Pat followed suit a few months later, but for them, the retreat yielded no change.
Yeah, so here they are finally, you know, doing some form of marriage counseling, although...
Right.
I don't know how effective it is. I mean, a lot of people find, you know, sort of marriage counseling through the church to be effective, and maybe that was the case for them, it seems like. But again, Candy and Pat are seemingly in the same place. That is just
right.
Kind of this stagnant, maybe roommate-ish relationship where they're just kind of going through the motions. But it does seem like Alan and Betty were starting to kind of find their way again.
Right. And I think part of that is probably because, you know, with the child, they actually both wanted to, you know, whereas like with Candy and Pat, I don't necessarily think that even that inclination to rebuild was there for Candy. I mean, we know nothing about Pat's view of everything.
Yeah,
but,
yeah.
You know, I think for Alan and Betty, there was this like renewed sense of like, we need to get back to where we started.
Which is great in theory, although the one thing that Alan did not do was tell Betty about the affair.
Right.
He kept that hidden and Candy did the same. So that is still this underlying sort of lie that they're, you know, sitting on top of and seemingly just trying to move on with life without facing, you know, their demons at this point.
Right.
And so everything remained buried until the morning of June 13th, 1980.
That Friday, which was a Friday the 13th, started like any other morning in Wiley. Candy had a full day ahead. She was helping at a children's choir performance at the church, and then her daughter had swim lessons. That evening, the family was planning to see the newly released Star Wars: The Empire Strikes Back. That morning, Candy's daughter asked if Elisa, who was Betty's older daughter, could come to the movie and sleep over. Candy agreed, but they would need Betty's permission, and if Elisa was coming to swim lessons too, they would need to grab her swimsuit first. So Candy decided to stop by the Gore house. She dropped her daughter off at church, let the adults that were there know that she would be right back, and headed over to the Gore's house on Dogwood Drive. She also planned to stop at Target afterward to pick up a Father's Day card for Pat. Now, this whole excursion should have been a 20-minute errand. Around 10:30 in the morning, Candy knocked on the Gore's front door, and Betty answered. It's important to note that Alan had left the house earlier that morning for a business trip to Minnesota. But as far as we know, the interaction seemed completely normal at first. Candy explained why she was there, so Betty invited her inside. Now, the events that transpired within the Gore residence remain among the most contentious aspects of this entire case. It is important to approach the following sequence of events with caution, as it relies heavily on Candy's personal testimony, which later on becomes highly scrutinized. According to Candy, the interaction began with a few minutes of casual chit-chat before things took a sharp turn. Betty reportedly confronted Candy directly, asking if she was having an affair with her husband, Alan. Candy actually admitted to the relationship, but maintained that it had concluded long ago, insisting Betty had no reason for concern. At that point, apparently, Betty briefly exited the room, only to return, wielding an axe. Candy claimed that Betty threatened her, telling her to never see Alan again. Candy said she promised she wouldn't. She said she tried to de-escalate, repeatedly telling Betty she didn't want to fight. But according to Candy's testimony, Betty swung the axe, and it grazed Candy's toe. And then a struggle ensued as they moved through multiple rooms of the house. Candy says she managed to wrestle the axe away from Betty, and then she killed her.
So this is where things get absolutely insane. And Candy, I believe, was wearing flip-flops that day, which is why when Betty supposedly swung the axe, she sort of missed, and then it came down and sliced her toe. But I'm like, an axe?
An axe? I don't know. I personally think that injury would be better explained by the person wielding the axe, maybe striking the whatever they're striking, going through it, and then, you know, with that
totally
resistance.
I mean, axes are heavy, man.
Axes are heavy. If
hard
you,
to control.
Right. And if you missed an entire person and then came down on their toe, I wouldn't leave just like a graze like that, or at least in my imagination.
Yeah. Well, this is what makes the case so haunting. It's not just that Betty Gore lost her life. It was how she was killed. Because, again, according to Candy, she then takes the axe and strikes Betty 41 times.
Yeah.
41. With 28 of those axe strikes going straight to Betty's head.
I mean, that's overkill if I've ever heard of it.
Yes. I mean, that's putting it lightly. Candy would later describe a moment during this struggle where Betty told her to shush. And something about that word broke something open in her. She later testified that it triggered a memory from her childhood A piece of glass had hit her face and she had started screaming, and her mother had shushed her to be quiet. And when Betty said it that day in the utility room, Candy said she had completely lost control because she just kept swinging the axe. She hit Betty's legs, her torso, her face over and over and over again. And she only stopped when her body was too exhausted to continue. And we'll talk more about, you know, what happens later on in the trial, but I wanted to put this in here because this is just absolutely insane and speaks to the just level of brutality that Betty experienced. Dr. Vincent DiMaio later testified at trial that Betty's heart was still beating for 40 of those 41 blows. She was alive for almost all of it. It was just insane.
I mean, that's unbearable.
Yeah. I mean, that is extremely brutal way to die. And when it was finally over, Betty lay dead on the floor of her own utility room. Candy was standing over her, covered in blood, and from somewhere else in that house came the sound of Betty's daughter crying in her crib. And what Candy does next is just as shocking and difficult to process as the attack itself. Because you would think in this type of situation, if things went according to what Candy said, she would have called the police immediately.
Right.
Right?
I was attacked and defended myself.
Right. You would want to get ahead of that because obviously the scene does not look good. But that's not what she did. She did not get help. She didn't call the police. She actually went into Betty's bathroom and took a shower and cleaned herself off and also tended to her injured toe. She then changed her clothes and she just left the house. She then just went on with the rest of her day. She went and picked up her daughter from church, took her to swim lessons, and spent the evening at home with her family. Witnesses who saw Candy that day later said she seemed completely normal. There was obviously no signs of distress or panic. I mean, nothing suggested that anything like what actually happened did. I mean, right. She just seemed completely fine, which that point is shocking as well. If you just had to defend yourself in a violent attack with an axe, you think you would be really shooken up over that.
Right. As opposed to just going about the motions as usual, going to church, picking up your daughter, picking up the woman, like spending the evening with the woman you just killed, her daughter.
Yeah.
And
taking a shower in their bathroom. Like, that is so bizarre. That is serial killer behavior.
Absolutely.
Here's the hardest part for people to live with. Candy had also gone back to church earlier that afternoon to help with vacation Bible school. That is crazy. She was there with kids, including Elisa. And hours after killing her mother, she was in a room full of children singing songs. That's just insane.
Yeah.
Elisa, Betty's oldest daughter, had been with Candy all day, and she had no idea what had happened at her house. And Bethany, Betty's, infant daughter, less than a year old, was still in the house, unattended, in her crib, and alone. And obviously her mother is gone. Meanwhile, Alan had been calling the house for Betty throughout the whole day with no response. And obviously when your wife's not picking up, you're going to start to get very, very concerned. That evening, Alan called Candy and she told him that she had stopped by the house that morning, but Betty seemed fine when she left. She also told him that Elisa was safe at her house. And as the night went on, Alan grew more worried and ended up calling his neighbor Richard Parker between 10 and 11 p.m. and asked him to go over to his house to check on Betty. He told Richard that he had his permission to kick down the door if needed so he could get inside. So Richard headed over to the Gore's house, and once there, he noticed that the garage door was open and that some of the lights in the house were on. And for some reason, Richard did not go fully into the house. I think he just kind of went over there and he's like, seems like someone's home.
Right.
Seems like things are fine. And that was the extent of him checking on Betty at this point. So when Alan talks to him again, he's like, so is everything okay? And he tells him, well, I didn't actually go into the house and actually physically make contact with Betty. Alan, that did not satisfy Alan whatsoever. So he started calling more neighbors. And one of those neighbors was a volunteer firefighter named Lester Gaylor. And he asked him to go back over there with Richard and do a full check of the house. And by this point, it was very late. And Alan knew it was extremely unlike Betty to not pick up the phone. especially since he knew she was taking care of Bethany, who was an infant at the time. So Lester and Richard headed back over to the Gore's house, knocked on the door, and no one answered. And from the outside, they could hear Bethany crying, and so they entered the home. Once inside the foyer, the house just did not feel like an empty house, and they immediately got the feeling that something was terribly wrong. And first thing, they went to Bethany's room and found her in her crib. She was red-faced, hoarse, and sitting in a soiled diaper, which that is just heartbreaking to hear that this poor child has just been sitting in, you know, a dirty diaper for hours on end, crying, you know, completely beside herself, you know, wanting her mother to come and take care of her, right. And she never does. Richard then picked her up and took her next door to his wife. And then the two men kept moving through the house looking for Betty. As they moved through the house, it became clear that a violent struggle had taken place. And once they got to the utility room, their suspicions were unfortunately confirmed. The door was closed, and when Lester cracked it open, they saw Betty lying on her back on the floor in a pool of blood. And actually, there's not a whole lot of clips that still remain from this case, but there is a clip of Lester actually recalling that day in an interview he gave a few years ago. Let's take a look at that.
I've seen a lot of people dying in a lot of different ways, but that's the worst I ever seen. I live with it day and night when it first happened. She was a school teacher. He worked at TI. They'd come over and we'd meet at the fence and such as that. They were very, very good people. Parker and Jerry went down the hall to the bedroom and they heard a baby cry, and I went in the kitchen and the laundry room, and there it was. I mean, blood everywhere, axe marks up around the ceiling, like they hit the wall, and they was 40-something axe marks in the body. They all brought dinner over here, and she walked in, they introduced us, and she had her bowl of whatever. They had her dinner over there, and you would never suspicion that she was nervous in any sort of way. Justice wasn't served. She had an affair, and it mushroomed on her, and she killed her. I don't think I'll do an interview ever again. And here I am in 2022, doing it again. Now, this is my last time. No more. I'm 83 years old. I want to live the rest of my days in peace. This is not peace. Ready to call a nightmare a bad dream and get through with it.
They also noticed that there was an axe lying nearby. The handle and the head were coated in blood, consistent with chopping. Lester then called Alan and told him that Betty had been shot. And I think he just said this sort of in a panic, and he actually meant to, you know, tell her she was likely killed with an axe per se, but maybe he was just also confused just by the scene. It was so bloody and disturbing that he just kind of blurted it out, you know?
Well, and I kind of like putting myself in his shoes, you know, I'd probably see the body and then kind of want to turn away and not look at it long enough. And just assuming with the amount of blood around, I'd probably say something similarly like, yeah, she was shot, you know?
But after that, Richard and Lester then left the house, called the police, and the investigation began.
So investigator Steve Defebaugh with the Collin County Sheriff's Office arrived after midnight. And when he arrived, the front door was already taped off with scotch tape, with notes that said, do not enter. When he arrived, the front yard was already crawling with media and other neighbors wanting to know what had happened. Investigators could immediately tell that this was not a random crime. There were no signs of forced entry, nothing had been taken, and due to the violent nature of the attack, it was clear that it was likely personal. Inside the utility room, the gruesome scene was almost too much to take in. Betty's body had suffered massive trauma, and half her face was essentially gone. They noted that she had deep wounds all over her body and had suffered extensive blood loss. They noticed that a bloody axe was lying against the wall and was clearly the weapon used in the attack. They also noticed that tucked under one of Betty's thighs was a bloody footprint. So it became obvious that someone had been in that room with her. They noted that the footprint was rather small, suggesting it was a woman's or a younger person's. Inside the bathroom, the brutal scene continued. They found blood, hair, and disturbed bath mats. Investigators immediately put it together that someone had gone into the bathroom to clean themselves up after the attack, which, as an investigator, I feel like that would just kind of break me a little bit.
Yeah, definitely send chills down your spine.
Right.
This person then proceeded to go into the bathroom and clean themselves.
Right. When they searched the bedroom, a roll of 35mm film and a $20 bill were sitting out in plain view, further backing up their theory that this was not a robbery.
Because again, there's no signs of forced entry as well. So they're like, you know, already kind of leaning away from that this is likely whoever this attacker was somebody that the victim knew. But then it's just further reinforced by the fact that nothing is taken from the house.
Nothing. There's money in clear sight. And
yep.
Didn't take it. And even more bizarre was on the dining room table, they found a copy of the Dallas Morning News open to the movie listings. One of the ads on that page was for The Shining. For a moment, investigators wondered if they were looking at someone who'd been chewing on that idea and, you know, potentially did a copycat crime.
Yeah, right.
The police then called Betty's family in Kansas to let them know that Betty had been murdered. Her family was devastated and completely shocked by the news. And immediately they jumped in the car and drove 5 hours to Wiley the next morning. When they arrived, they were met with an intense scene of police and media everywhere. When they spoke with Alan that night, he told them Candy may have been the last person to see Betty alive. The next day, investigators talked to Candy, and she just gave a simple story. She had stopped by briefly to get the swimsuit, and then she left. At this point, investigators believed her, at least at first. Candy was described as a petite woman, and it was hard for people to believe that she had the force to do what had been done to Betty. They took her fingerprints as a matter of routine, since she had been the last person in that house. They also looked hard at Alan. His demeanor was strange enough to draw attention. Oddly unemotional, detached, investigators asked him about enemies, about affairs, and he initially denied any affairs. He agreed to be fingerprinted and to take a polygraph, but the harder fact was the alibi. He was on a plane to Minneapolis at the time of the killing, and he had plane tickets and hotel receipts, as well as people who saw him, and it was clear that it all lined up. He was gone at the time of the attack. Investigators also walked through a murder-for-hire scenario, but they didn't like it because a paid hit doesn't look like 41 axe blows. It looks like a single bullet, you know, quick and clean, and this was obviously the opposite. The next morning, Alan called Chief Abbott and admitted he'd lied. He'd been having an affair with Candy Montgomery, and he eventually passed a polygraph on whether he had killed Betty or arranged for her to be killed. So with that, the investigators moved on from him. Within days, the Gore phone rang again, and this time it wasn't a neighbor. A man's voice on the other end said, "I killed her." He went further and threatened Betty's daughter. Police told the family to keep him on the line if he called back. Betty's brother Ron took over the phone when the caller rang back, and Ron tried to keep him talking. The call was traced, and it was actually coming from a mental institution. The man had no car and hadn't even left the building. He had a phone book, and he picked the Gores out of it just looking for attention. After that, the police blocked the calls from that facility, and this was clearly just harassment and not a credible lead. But that's got to be just horrifying as a family member to receive this call from a strange man.
Yeah, and now they're threatening her daughter.
Right, like this is going to continue.
Yeah, God, the days of the phone book. Just pick up the phone book and like look up anybody in the area's number.
Right. Then the lab work came back. A bloody thumbprint had been found on the freezer in the utility room. An expert from the Dallas County Sheriff's Office compared it to Candy's rolled prints and found more than the minimum number of matching points. This print was hers. The small, bloody footprint at the scene was consistent with her size, too. And once the affair with Alan came out, there was a motive sitting right there. That shifted everything. Investigators now had a possible motive, jealousy, revenge, and so they brought Candy back in for more questioning. She stuck to her story until then, when investigators laid out the evidence stacked against her. At that point, Candy confessed, but not to murder. She said she had killed Betty in self-defense. When law enforcement called her in again to ask for a polygraph, she refused. And then she got an attorney. On June 27, 1980, about 2 weeks after Betty was killed, Candy Montgomery was charged with her murder. Her attorneys arranged for her to turn herself in, and she did. She was arrested on camera, read her rights, and booked into jail. At intake, the jail noted what was on her body. Bruises, including a gash on the third toe of her left foot. And it's important, again, that this detail will matter.
But it was very obvious that she had been in a very physical, violent struggle. Because
right.
There were literally bruises all over her.
And then we have a clip of Candy when she was charged.
You have the right to remain silent and not say anything. Any oral or written statement may be used in evidence in this court. You have the right to have your lawyer present to advise you before or during any questioning by peace officers or attorneys representing the state. If you are too poor to hire a lawyer, then the court will appoint a lawyer for you free of charge, and he can advise you before or during any questioning. You can decide to talk with anyone, and you can stop talking to them at any time you want. The above rights are continuing rights, which can be heard by you at any state of proceedings.
So the quiet suburban community of Wiley was shaken to its core. This was the kind of place where people didn't lock their doors and trusted their neighbors. But now a popular housewife in the community stood accused of brutally killing another woman with an axe in her own utility room.
Candy Montgomery's trial began in October 1980, and the lawyers she retained, Don Crowder and Robert Udashin, were certainly interesting choices. Don Crowder was a friend from church and a city attorney for the town of Allen, Texas. Robert Udashin was a 27-year-old associate who had only been out of law school for 3 years. And the thing about these guys is that neither of them had ever tried a criminal case before, which doesn't seem like a smart move.
No, this seems like a rather...
civil attorney and a fresh out of law school. Attorney.
Right.
But Candy believed that these guys were the right pick to represent her. This case quickly became high profile and a media sensation because people were absolutely fascinated by the details of the case. Because again, you got two homemakers, two housewives, a secret affair, brutal killing. I mean, if something like that happened today, it would absolutely be a big media sensation.
Oh, definitely. 100%.
Probably even more so now.
Right.
And, you know, all of it is just so perplexing, and it's just like, it's shocking, right? It's like, what? These two attacked each other
right.
this violently? It's hard to look away. And then in open court at jury selection, Don Crowder did something that completely stopped the room. He said Candy Montgomery had killed Betty Gore with an axe and that she'd done it in self-defense. During the trial, Candy's defense team built its case around, of course, the self-defense argument. They argued that Betty had been the aggressor and had attacked Candy with the axe first. But that wasn't the only strategy that they used. They also leaned heavily on the psychological piece. Dr. Fred Faison testified that the word shush had triggered a dissociative reaction in Candy, which pulled her back to that childhood memory of being silenced, and it caused sort of this temporary break from reality tied to this unresolved trauma. And in that moment, the defense argued that Candy was not fully in control of what she was doing.
And, you know, this reminds me, I know last week you guys did Billy Milligan, and this is all around the same time.
A Mile Higher, yeah.
A Mile Higher, yes. Yeah. And this is all around the same time, and I think there was just this fascination in the late 70s with pop psychology. And there was this kind of like, I would say, you know, misunderstanding with the general public that it's almost like a superpower, like it's spiritual in some way, that like, you know, with one word, with shush, suddenly, you know,
it's like sucked out of her body,
right?
And like seeing it from a third perspective, you know, party perspective,
right?
And you know, out of control of herself. Yeah,
it sounds like sorcery. And I think the I think they really kind of played into this.
Totally. I mean, that's all they have.
Right.
Literally. I mean, otherwise, other than Betty attacked her first, I mean, and I think they knew just based off of that fact, that's going to be tough to argue.
Right.
Because again, you know, it was 41 times with an axe. And so I think they, you know, the defense was smart to try to insert this and then bring in an expert to back it up.
Right.
As far as this, you know, unresolved trauma, this trigger that happened that then made her lose control. But that was, that was the way they went. Whereas the prosecution, you know, seems pretty straightforward on what their game plan would be. They're going to focus on the fact that Candy struck Betty 41 times. They pointed out that even if Betty had been the aggressor, let's be honest, I think we all can agree on this, is that 41 strikes with an axe is not self-defense.
Right.
Like, it's just not.
No, there's absolutely no reality where that is the case.
So they painted the picture of a woman consumed by something that went far beyond fear, and something that did not stop, even though the threat was gone. Because it just doesn't make sense. So they walked the jury back through the evidence. They walked them through the bloody thumbprint on the freezer, the bathroom that was used to clean up, you know, the small footprint found underneath Betty's body, and of course, you know, the fact that Bethany was left alone in the house for hours. So how do you explain that in a self-defense? Right. Because if it's truly self-defense, why on earth would Candy have done the things after the attack that she did? It just makes zero sense whatsoever. I mean, she showered, she changed, she just left Bethany alone in her crib and then went about her day.
Right. Well, and I also think this is an infant that, you know, Candy knew quite well. And if it was truly self-defense, you'd expect some sort of empathy or care to be shown to the infant afterwards, as opposed to just, you know, leaving her in its crib.
And maybe one, you know, the defense would argue, well, you know, she had this, you know, dissociative moment or whatever you want to call it. And she was just out of her mind at this point,
right,
and wasn't thinking clearly. And so she did what she did because of that.
Right.
Which maybe. But to the prosecution, it seemed very clear that this was somebody removing an obstacle from her life in order to potentially get what she wanted. After the prosecution rested, something unusual happened. Candy Montgomery was the first witness called by her own defense team, which, as most of us know, taking the stand is an enormous risk for any defendant. But in this case, it may have been the right call. But after several days of testimony, the jury deliberated for about 3 hours, which was a lot faster than anybody expected, I think. It was a pretty quick decision here. And what's even more shocking is that on October 30th, 1980, Candy Montgomery was found not guilty by reason of self-defense.
Which, I mean, that's what I said at the beginning. That's the shocking part of this whole thing. It's extremely upsetting.
I don't understand that at all. I would love to hear from the jury members what on earth they were thinking. And maybe they bought into, you know, sort of the psych-eval stuff. And, you know, as you said, a lot of that was very sort of pop culture at the time.
Right.
You know, it was kind of in the ethos at the time and other cases going on. And so, I don't know. It was either that or they just misinformed, or maybe Candy was very, very convincing on the stand.
Right.
And I mean, really convinced them somehow.
It's her talking on the stand, this nice little housewife. How could she do this in cold blood?
Right. You know, petite little woman swinging this axe 41 times. I wouldn't have been able to do that if I wasn't, you know, having, you know, out of my mind moment here. And it's kind of what it seems like. But to just completely acquit her was just absolutely insane. The courtroom was stunned, and there was a roar in the room when it came down. The jury of 9 women and 3 men had accepted the self-defense argument, and they believed there was enough reasonable doubt about whether Candy had intended to kill Betty that day. The proposed motive, that Candy was still carrying feelings for Alan, didn't hold up, because the affair had ended months before the killing. And by all accounts, including Alan's testimony, Candy appeared to have already moved on. And because there was enough doubt, Kenny Montgomery walked out of that courthouse as a free woman. People who watched the whole trial didn't believe the verdict was right, and some of them weren't sure that the defense lawyers even believed it either. But Betty's family and supporters feel Candy got away with murder, and obviously see this outcome as absolutely crushing and devastating. And they blame the prosecution, because I think the prosecution was overly confident in this case and probably did not approach it the right way, obviously, because they just felt like they had this slam dunk case. And I think on paper, if you look at it from, you know, an aerial view, it seems like very obvious here what happened, but that wasn't the case.
Right. So following her acquittal, Candy tried to rebuild her life, but things were never the same in Wiley. The community that had once embraced her now viewed her through a very different lens. Within a few months, she, Pat, and the children moved to Georgia. A few years later, she and Pat divorced, which, probably a few years too late. Reports indicate that she changed her name back to Candace Wheeler and went on to work as a mental health counselor.
Crazy.
Just...
What? In,
yeah, I know.
Yeah, this is another shocking turn of events, the fact that she's worked as a mental health professional.
You know, I think you should be able to ask your therapist, like, so what's your personal background?
Yeah. Yeah, how'd she even pull this off without people freaking out?
Right, like, oh, the murderer? it's crazy. She is now in her mid-70s and keeps an extremely private life. As for Alan Gore, he remarried not long after the acquittal. Betty's parents in Kansas were given full custody of Elisa and Bethany, and the girls were raised there. And, you know, I think the family still kind of expresses this real distaste and basically dislike for Alan because of remarrying so quickly afterwards.
Yeah, that was pretty slimy. Yeah. Like, how do you think that was going to look? To his family, like, and Betty's family.
Right. In later interviews, the daughters describe growing up with the weight of unanswered questions. They eventually reconnected with their father as adults, and they did develop a relationship with him. According to reports, both girls went on to build meaningful lives under their grandparents' care. Bethany, who was less than a year old on the day her mother died, is said to have followed in Betty's footsteps by becoming a teacher. Betty's brother has said, in his own words, that he still doesn't have peace. He keeps telling the story, and he wants people to remember who Betty actually was, so that, as he puts it, she fails no one in the future. So her memory still does some kind of work in the world.
I mean, how do you even move on with this miscarriage of justice that happened? I mean, it's just insane.
You don't even, like, your sister's gone. And the woman who did it is a therapist somewhere in Georgia.
Yeah.
So the Dallas Morning News reported years later that when a journalist reached out to Candy on the anniversary of Betty's death to request an interview, Candy replied, "I'm telling you in big, bold letters, I'm not interested." Her silence has done nothing to quiet the conversations about this case.
Which, of course, she doesn't want to talk about this.
No. She's like, I got off.
Yeah. Why would I potentially incriminate myself by telling people what really happened?
Right. And, you know, she's, by all accounts, living a professional, quiet life. You know, she doesn't want to interrupt that for any reason.
Because, like, if you look at it either way, if Betty did grab an axe and come at Candy, maybe she was enraged when she found out, and maybe, you know, even if Betty did start the attack,
right,
it does not excuse the way Candy finished it. There's no way to possibly make that make sense.
And she never really, I mean, aside from this blind rage thrown into her from the dissociative, you know, episode, she hasn't really explained the 41 blows, and I think that's the main question we have now, is like, why did you hit her so many times outside of this dissociative episode?
Yeah. I don't know. I don't understand you know, the psychological explanation all that deeply. So I can't really speak on that, but just from a very basic level of understanding of it, it makes some sense. But how does that then fuel you to swing that axe 41 times
right.
on a human being? And, you know, she's effectively alive during most of it.
Right.
And fighting you as well. It just doesn't make any sense to me.
Well,
I don't get it.
And then to not only shower, clean up, all this, but then just go about your day.
Yeah. And maybe that does speak to some larger psychological issue with Candy that is right. undiagnosed or something like that. I mean, last week with Krista Pike, in a way, it's kind of reminding me a bit of Krista Pike, who also was not diagnosed with something. And, you know, she brutally murdered another woman and took a piece of her skull and did all this Oof. Really heinous shit. Yeah. And, you know, although she had a more of a violent history, and, you know, there were definite indicators from earlier in her childhood. She was also traumatized and abused as a child as well. And I mean, we don't fully know Candy's background, so maybe right. there's some of that in there. I mean, it sounds like her mother was abusive in one way or another. And so maybe it's a similar type of situation there, that there's something that was just lying in wait deep inside of her that was unleashed that day. And even if that's the case, though, I don't think that results in acquitting her. And maybe I think really the prosecution really fucked up by not looking into this case further, not doing their homework, and making sure that that was the right charge to go right. with, right? Because if you go with that first degree murder charge, you got to be able to prove that beyond a reasonable doubt. And I think they should have probably, you know, in many other cases like this, I feel like a competent prosecutor would have gone with, you know, negligent homicide, manslaughter, you know, some other form of homicide or manslaughter to at least get her on something, as opposed right. to kind of the all or nothing approach and being overly confident in just the scene and evidence itself. But can't go back now.
Can't go back now. No. I also think another thing they should have done easily would be to get, you know, another expert, a mental health expert, to give a differing opinion.
Totally. Yeah. Have her evaluated by multiple.
Right.
Yeah. They really messed up by not doing that. This is probably like the first case they've had that was like this. And they're like, look, you know, we'll show the jury the crime scene photos, the axe, you know, all of these things. And how can anybody not convict
right.
her after seeing this? And didn't work.
Right.
Crazy.
But like we said, this story has lingered in pop culture for decades. In recent years, it was adapted into two separate television series, each with its own take on what happened inside that house on Dogwood Drive. The first was Candy, which premiered on Hulu on May 9th, 2022, where Jessica Biel plays Candy Montgomery, depicting her as composed on the outside but carrying something much heavier beneath the surface. Melanie Lynskey plays Betty, bringing out her isolation and emotional exhaustion. Pablo Schreiber plays Alan, and Timothy Simons plays Pat. The series leans into suspense and the darker undercurrents of suburban life, and it plays with some ambiguity around exactly how things unfolded that morning. Then in April 2023, HBO Max released Love and Death, a 7-episode series inspired by the book Evidence of Love by John Bloom and Jim Atkinson, which was based on extensive interviews with both families. Elizabeth Olsen plays Candy in a quieter, more inward performance. Lily Rabe plays Betty, and Jesse Plemons plays Alan. Patrick Fugit plays Pat. This version spends more time in the religious and small town world these people inhabited, and follows Candy's version of events much more closely. Both shows are based on the same real-life events, but differ in other ways. Candy is more tense and thriller-like, and portrays the multiple ways the killing could have unfolded. While Love and Death slows things down and focuses more on how Candy claims things unfolded. And while both shows were very popular, it wasn't easy for Betty's family to see. A relative who spoke under anonymity in an interview said, "It's extremely frustrating and definitely stressful. I hate that when I want to scroll through the Hulu menu, I get slammed with a giant picture of candy."
Yeah, that's fucked.
It's fucked up.
I don't like this. I don't like taking these cases and then making dramatized versions of them.
Yeah.
It's just not needed.
And just because like there's absolutely no way you can simply stick to the facts.
No.
And there's something's going to be fictionalized. Something's going to be played up for drama.
And people are going to watch it and think that's the truth. That's right. That's the one of the biggest issues for me is that when people watch these dramatized versions of real killers and real cases, oftentimes the writers and directors are infusing it with, you know, a bunch of fictitious events and details. But a lot of people don't discern the fact that even if the director's like, this is fake. This is a fictionalized version of this. But it's just at the end of the day, imagine being a family member of Betty and sitting down on your couch and you just want to watch, you know, your favorite show, and you come across the woman that killed your sister,
right?
You know, and just, you know, sends you back and, you know, kind of makes you relive that day all over again. I mean, it seems lazy to me too. It just seems like, really, we can't come up with a new plot line, a new storyline. We can't. And it's exploitation, really. It's exploiting these families and the victims and glorifying the killer.
You know, I think the few of these kinds of fictionalized telling of real life crimes that I think does it well, it's a little more austere than a Hulu series, but Killers of the Flower Moon by Martin Scorsese, I think, does this sort of thing much more respectfully. But it also, like, not only does it have, like, you know, this bumper at the front, this is a fictionalized version, but it's baked into the story. There's even a part where Scorsese himself is telling the story as part of a radio play. And I think that kind of helps the audience know, like, this is not, you know, this is our best portrayal of it, but this is not the facts wholesale.
Yeah. I like that. Well, not only that, but involving the family too.
Right.
And like, if you're going to tell a family story, you should probably get their permission to do so. And if they don't want their story told in this way, then scrap it. You know, and that's the issue is, and Hulu's famous for doing this, but they don't even care.
They don't give a fuck. No.
They'll just do it whether you want to or not. And sometimes families even reach out to Hulu and try to stop it, and they just don't care. You know, they do what they want to do, and they've done this so many times. And, you know, it's for entertainment at the end of the day when it's anything but that for those affected by it. So it's just, again, I think if you do it, if you can do it right, and if the family wants to be involved and you're going to stick to the facts as much as you possibly can, then fine. But to just go like crazy with it and come up with all these new plot lines and
showing the killing in multiple different ways.
Right. Like, you know, here's a person portrayed that looks similar to Betty that you're, you know, having go through these violent events all over again, and the family could potentially come across it. I don't know. Just seems dirty to me.
Yeah. None of Betty's friends or family participated in the making of the show, like Josh said, and Candy has remained quiet about anything related to the case. All of these adaptations trace back to the same foundational account, the book Evidence of Love by John Bloom and Jim Atkinson, which drew on exclusive access to both families and was also adapted years earlier into the 1990 TV movie Killing in a Small Town.
And I mean, I see why, right?
Of course. Like,
you know, this is a quote unquote juicy plot line for any entertainment company. You know, it's almost so insane that, you know, one might say you couldn't make this up, you know? So, and I see the appeal from their side, but at the end of the day, it's like the family's publicly being like, hey, we don't want this.
Right.
Like, let's respect their wishes. But at the end of all this, I mean, this case has obviously never fully gone away, and it won't. I mean, this is a traumatic event that happened, a miscarriage of justice. You know, if you're looking at it from Betty's side of things, I think personally, that's the way I lean, is that this was a miscarriage of justice. I put a lot of the blame on the prosecution because it just seems very obvious that they approached this the wrong way and they didn't consider all of the factors that came into play here, as well as the psych eval details that sort of made its way from the defense side. And I think that really hosed them in a number of ways.
Yeah.
But I think all three of us are all in agreement that Betty was murdered and Candy got away with it.
Absolutely. 100%.
It's hard to deny that. But I want to know what you think out there. Where do you stand on this? Do you think Betty was the aggressor in this and Candy was initially defending herself and then ultimately had that psychotic episode or whatever, and she just took it way too far? Or do you think this was potentially a full-blown premeditated murder? Was Candy going over to Betty's house that day to murder Betty, and that was just the weapon that was there? Or, you know, for all we know, she could have brought it. I mean, it doesn't seem like they ever figured that out. So let us know your thoughts on this one. It's obviously horrible and sad at the end of the day, and I hope Betty's family's doing well. I hope her kids are thriving out there. I mean, what a horrible thing to live through. But that's going to be it for us today. Thank you for being here with us, and we'll see you guys next week with another one. Till then, lights out, everybody.